Welcome back, everybody. It's time for another episode of Driven by Design, the only show that shows you the future of automotive design and transportation in general, with our driven transportation chief, our designer in chief, Brian Thompson. Hey, Brian.
Hello, hello. You can't see me, but I'm dancing around to my own music.
That is pretty cool. That is a pretty cool opening thing there. I gotta give you that.
I hope it gets people up and moving.
It does. It gets me up moving. Well, because it's about moving. It's about get what drives you these days here. Well, we're for those that are listening in the future, this is a podcast we're doing at the end of 2019. We're going to do, like we always do at this time of year, at the end of the year, look back at the stories that drove us maybe crazy, or drove us to distraction, or drove us to be interested.
And the new frontiers.
Yes. And then in the second half, we're going to do a two-parter again. We seem to specialize in two-parters on this show. We'll take a look at, we'll have him put on his Karnak. I'm dating myself. Nobody remembers Johnny Carson and Karnak here. His who's a modern equivalent? Who predicts the future? Whoever it is going to put on his turban and look into his crystal ball and see if he can't do it. Because not only is he guessing, because he's an educated person in this field, he's got the right to guess. He's working on it. That's what's bizarre about your industry. You know, you're working on the future today. So we'll talk about some of that to the extent you can share it. But let's start with, I wrote up a whole bunch of questions, and I'm sure there's some other ones you want to talk about as well. But let me start off by saying, let's look at, to me, two or three of the stories that captivated me, that drove me this year. One was one that, and for those who don't know or don't remember, I'm a big fan of transportation. I grew up in Detroit in the belly of the beast. My dad was an executive for Chrysler Corporation. Everybody on my block, every kid I knew at school, their father had something to do with the car business. I mean, it was an industry town. It was the water we swam in. It was like being up in Hollywood or something. Everybody was immersed in that industry. And at that time, we used to say that not only was it, you know, maybe that was just our fantasy, but not only was it a big deal to most people, and particularly to us, what color the car, what was the name of the car, what was coming up. We were really into this stuff, probably even more than the public was. But 20%, one out of five jobs, they used to say, had something to do with transportation in this country. You think it's still that big? Is this still an industry that not only drives our imagination but drives our economy?
Well, I mean, the industry is growing from what, you know, the concept of what a car is changing, right? So I don't know statistical numbers, but, you know, you think about every aspect of transportation now that's available and how things are evolving from, you know, ride shares to those sort of litter economies of the little scooters and things like
the
that.
The litter economy, yeah, exactly. You know, the throwaway right? version of transportation, yeah.
And, you know, you see them all over, the little birds and slimes and stuff, but that's kind of like litter, but they're, you know, that'll be a great thing to
send see. All your comments to Brian Thompson. I didn't call these little things litter here. You can all the people who are going to get angry and all the PR people that want to be on the show to refute
litter
that.
Economy. I think we coined that on this show.
I think you did.
Well, you know,
it's true that we have a litter economy. We just litter the world with these things. We throw them away.
It's interesting, though, because I noticed the bikes that are, you know, like wheels, they don't get tossed about. It's like, I think there's something.
You've said that before, and I never really thought about it, but you're right. When people, mm-hmm. when they get a rental bike, maybe it's because it's bigger and more substantial, but you think what? It goes back to our childhood and how important that bike was to us?
We got on a bike when we were kids. We were so excited for Christmas to get a bike, and then when you got done with it, you put the kickstand down, and you left it standing there. And a scooter, you know, you typically would, like, you know, lean it against something or put it in the garage, you know, if you had one. But I think there's a sort of a little ritual of putting the kickstand down that is so ingrained in people that they just do it. And so when you see those little wheels bikes, they're standing. They're not thrown over. And so that's, you know, it's kind of a nice little thing.
Well, here's a spoiler alert. We haven't confirmed the date, but we confirmed his appearance this past week. Don DeCostanza, you don't even know this is going to be on your show. chief executive officer and the creator of Pedego Electric Bikes. I believe they're the largest electric bike manufacturer in the or dealer, whatever, company in the world. And they're based here in Orange County. And he's been on a couple of our shows and would love to come on and talk about, because he's got some really ideas about how bikes, how transportation is changing, and bikes in particular have evolved and changed. So, all right, so again, I think this is still, maybe it's just me, maybe I'm still the kid of my Detroit days, but I think cars and transportation are still a big deal, even more so for Americans than for anybody else. It's the mythology of freedom. It's the mythology of the open road. It's the mythology of power and personal empowerment and all that. Talk about that. Is that still, do we still feel that in our veins, or am I just an old guy mythologizing about the old West?
American dream. It's really a part of the American dream that you can own a car. I mean, Route 66 is so ingrained in our culture, especially in the West Coast in California. That's why so many of the car studios moved out here. But, you know, I think people's desires and needs, those typically don't change drastically as much as the way that we meet them. So, yeah, as we sort of are on this cutting edge of this autonomous driving technology, you know, for a while it's going to be very exciting. It's going to be very sort of messy as it gets integrated, and you're going to hear a lot of, like, I don't want them to take my steering wheel. But that's not really what's happening, is right. It's like the idea of commuting and sitting for a long duration and just rush hour traffic, that will go away, and that'll be handled by the AI. But I think for a long time to come, the idea of driving of a car, of one that you have perception of control of, that's, we can discuss what perception of control is more deeply, but like the idea that you get to feel the steering wheel in your hand.
We're going to get that esoteric here. What is control? Who is in control? Are we in control of anything these days, Aaron?
Well, think about this. Okay, so people that will often say, you know, I'd never drive an autonomous car. They already have one. I mean, ABS is an autonomous system. It's impossible for a human being to put on the brakes and pulsate them as quickly as an ABS system. At that point, once you put on the brakes, you're just a director of operations. You're telling the car, I need to stop, and I need to stop right now. And the car itself is the one doing the stopping. There's no mechanical connection between you and the brakes.
Yeah.
And so that is right there.
And shifting. We did that. I mean, I was of that generation where we went from having to shift ourselves to automatic transmission.
I was in a car the other day that had a manual transmission, and I forgot to put in the clutch, and the damn car put the clutch in for me. Wait a minute. Who's the man behind the curtain here doing the work?
Who's in control after all here?
It's just placating, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretending that I'm in control here. And then, and my wife was a big fan of, she gave hers up reluctantly. She finally gave up because it was almost impossible to find cars with a stick shift version. But she liked that. She said, you know, she had the fantasy that she was in control, that she could get better gas mileage and all this other thing. I said, oh, come on. Those have been proven a long time ago. These computers can do it faster and better than we can here.
But I don't even think it's really about, I mean, that's what people tell themselves it's about. Sometimes they'll rationalize it, but it's really about the feeling. You know,
I
work on cars for the next 10, 20 years, I drive a Fiat 500, a BART, that has a 5-speed manual with a mechanical, you know, shifter.
And crazy ones.
Yeah, and it doesn't have anything to do with the performance of the vehicle, although I love how fast it is. But it's that feeling of shifting. It just gives me such a nice feeling of satisfaction.
And the sound. Like, vroom,
sound of
yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and I drive different in that car than like in some of my vintage, you know, 80s Japanese cars where you sort of like hold on with two fingers to the steering wheel and like one pinky up. But you know, with the Fiat, I'm like weaving in. I'm like, who is this guy? I'm weaving in and out of traffic like in a hurry to go to the same place that I never really need to get to that quickly.
Well, and I used to tell her all the time, she'd say, you know, but you have more control over the vehicle. I said, why don't we go back to the days when we had to do hand cranks, there wasn't a battery, and you had to jump the spark yourself here, you know. How much do you want to be in control? How much do you want to initiate in all this stuff here?
But I would ask her to extrapolate on that feeling of be in control. I think when people say those words, be in control, they're really talking about a feeling. They're talking about a feeling in
Probably.
Your stomach or a feeling in your hands or a visceral emotional reaction. And those are the words we use to describe those. You know, when people say, I bought my car for the fuel economy, or they rationalize it. What they're really talking about is an emotion that's sort of hidden underneath these like logical terms we'll use. Because, you know, do we really have control of a car with ABS and you know, traction control and every other system that's sort of waiting and ready to take over for us? Not really. It's all there ready, but it's that feeling. It's that feeling that makes you feel that visceral fun. I love driving. That is so important to driving. And I think certainly designers like me, I want to protect that and keep that going into the future as the sort of rideshare commuting autonomous driving sort of takes over.
That's going to be part two. I'm going to question whether or not we're going to have that same feeling for our vehicles, that same anthropomorphic, is that the right word, where they feel like they're human, they're an extension of us, if it's just a box, a robot that picks it up. But we'll keep that for the second part. Let me get from out there, let's get some emotion. Let's announce some sad passings. You know how, like at the Academy Awards, they announce everybody who died this year? I want to announce some things that died this year in transportation, one of which, my father's already passed away. He's already dead. But if he wasn't, he would have killed him, which is the death of the passenger vehicle.
The sedan.
The sedan. The two-door, four-door car that was the bread and butter of every manufacturer. It was every house had one, and then they started chipping away at it with these crossover utility vehicles, fifth-door tailgate stuff that started changing its feeling and stuff. And finally, was it Fiat this year? You finally threw in the towel? I think Ford as well. Said, we quit. We're not going to make them anymore.
Well, you know, think about what driving is and what driving's been. Okay, so first we had horses and carriages, right? And those weren't sedans. And then, you know, you evolve into sort of this a horse and carriage with a trunk on the back. Mm. And that's what sort of begat the sedan look, right? This three box, you know, we call it three box, a hood, a cabin, and a trunk. And that evolved in the 40s to really those vehicles in the 30s and 40s that everybody drove. Those were the modern day SUVs. If you think about it, they were proportionally crossovers because they had big.
How so? I don't know. You lost me on that one here. Okay.
Silhouette.
The look of it. Okay.
Yeah, well, the actual package that people sat in.
Right.
It's very similar to a modern day, you know, Ford Escape or Explorer or, you know, Fiat.
Because what they had that kind of bubble, that kind of raised roof kind of look to them here. They weren't low and sleek. They were.
They were designed for roads that were not finished like today's roads, right? So they really had to be living sort of as an urban, you know, off-road vehicle.
Yeah.
People forget that
the Model T, part of its popularity certainly was the price, but the other thing is that it could go through ruts and still can. I've seen people drive these things over, you know, giant ruts and holes and everything because there were dirt roads that had that weren't smooth and paved. It had to be with the giant balloon tires.
As those roads sort of evolved and cleaned up, you know, you got cars that were lower slung and had, you know, the long, you know, getting to the 50s with the jet age and the, you know, the space age and being fired by rocket ships. Everything's low and slung low and got these wide proportions and stuff.
And big fins. Come on, don't forget the big fins. I loved all that.
But then what came out of that? The station wagon, right? So, the need, if you look at the history of cars, then the need kind of doesn't change. People need to move people and move their stuff.
Right.
So, like, the you know, as the 60s came in, you know, or, you know, even in the 50s, 60s, the family station wagon came, right?
Well,
the family station wagon was, you know, the great Route 66, go camping, go on trips with your loved ones, bench seats, you can put your arm around your wife, you know, it's very family oriented.
Right.
Until the station wagon became passe, and then
because you had three rows now, that trunk went away and we could sit in the trunk basically. You could store face stuff backwards. In it, or you could face backwards and sit in the trunk.
Oh my God, how many memories I remember.
I love that
Chevrolet was it a Caprice wagon, Impala maybe, lower model, and we, you know, just how many kids doesn't have, how many kids have that memory of fighting with each other and like then making faces at the car behind you and throwing things out the window,
right?
Because ours had like a roll down window, you could throw stuff at people.
Yeah,
terrible.
And get them to honk or something, and get them make say, like honk for anything. Yeah.
Or try to get them to like swerve, which is what we were trying to do.
You terrorists. Okay.
Yeah, but then the wagon, if you will,
went away,
lost its cachet, and then what came out in 84, Chrysler's minivan.
Yeah.
Same thing, but now it's in a compact minivan, but it's a place to put your stuff and things. Minivan.
But the door slid open instead of flung open. They were giant, and they were easier to put. You could put more stuff in it. It was a big box, and it was so well engineered, so well designed, I'll say designed first and then engineered, that you could stow it under and over and around, and they'd show you the endless configurations, remove the seats and do all sorts of stuff. It was the first utility vehicle that was created.
Yeah, and so that innovation gave it a cutting edge feeling. Of what was out of style at that moment? The station wagon.
Oh.
Nobody wants to be seen in a station wagon.
Nobody.
Right? And then same thing happens to the minivan. The minivan goes along, it becomes it's a cutting edge. You know, when Chrysler came out with the Voyager and the Caravan, you know, it was a big deal until everybody had one and everybody's mom drove one.
Right.
And everybody associated that with, you know,
not cool.
Not cool.
Right.
Right. And then what came out? The SUV.
Yeah.
Which is the same thing. It's just now we're going back to the 40s. It's a tall vehicle with large tires, but you're still moving people and their stuff. And then the SUV was replaced by the crossover.
Yeah, which is
but if you look at it, all the history of it, it's all the same thing. It's just different proportions of the same thing.
But what has disappeared is the old passenger four-seat car, two in the front, two in the back, and two rows, and mom and dad in the front, kids in the back, or whatever. Everybody had to have it was a car strictly for passengers. You might try and stuff things in the trunk. You might try and stick more people in it. But it was there to move passengers around. It wasn't a truck, and it wasn't a catch-all that had all these other things to it. Why did my dad died about 6 years ago. He could never understand the appeal of trucks, minivans, and later SUVs. He just couldn't get that.
Right. Well, that makes sense because the generational association that we have with those things, you know, and just like...
And at the upper end, you still have... It's keep in mind, it's only the passenger vehicle from the midsize down that disappeared. There's no demise of the Mercedes-Benz and the... BMWs and
Teslas. You could argue that Tesla's a hatchback, but the interesting thing with that is that the sedan actually didn't go away. You know, if you think about what the sedan was a ladder frame chassis with a body on it that was essentially a truck.
A ladder frame, because it literally looked like a ladder when it did before it had the body on it. Right.
So when you have in automotive, there's a ladder frame, and then there's a unibody, and then there's space frame. But we don't need to go into all those. Basically, ladder frame is a frame. It's like a cake with a body on top of it. Right.
Right.
You know, that's the body, and the body comes off, and it's not part of the structure.
Right.
But what stayed in the market that swallowed up the sedan? It's not the crossover, it's not the SUV, it's the American truck.
Yes. So
we still have sedans. The cabin got bigger,
yeah,
and the bed got smaller. So if you really look at a modern day Ford F-150 or Chevy truck, you know, Dodge, I mean, even
Ram.
Nissan, I mean, heck, the Nissan Titan was the first vehicle I worked on when I got out of college. We made that cabin so big that the A-pillars were almost touched down at the wheels. And if you really think about it, that's the modern-day American sedan. All of the creature comforts that started to appear in the truck, the trunk is just basically the bed.
But
the proportions are all there. So I would argue that the American sedan is still alive and well. It just looks like a truck now.
Interesting you say that. So yeah, I've never thought about that. You're going to have to. I'm going to have to go back and think about it but you're right. I mean, it's the inside of the truck is there. The truck was designed to carry heavy stuff, and there's some appeal. But 99% of the people I know that have a truck don't carry anything but themselves. It is in that sense much more of a passenger vehicle than it is hauling stuff.
Yeah, you use it. I know. I just got a truck. I just got a Nissan Hardbody from 1988, and it's like I had to have it because it was designed by the guys we were talking about last week, Jerry Hirschberg and Tom Temple and all those guys, and really talented truck. And guys, and that truck is so beautiful. I had to have it. Now I'm like riding around. I'm like, oh, I'm a truck guy.
When did this happen?
I've designed trucks, but I didn't ever really think I'd ever own one.
So truck guys are just the modern equivalent of the sedan. I've never thought of it. Interesting idea. Okay, so then I'm not going to cry too much for the demise of the sedan. It lives on in today's truck.
You can even have your bench seat in a truck. So
all right, so that was one, the demise of the passenger vehicle, but you're saying it just evolved into something else, the trucks. The minivan turned into the SUV, turned into the crossover, this multi-purpose, multi-utility, five-door thing. Will we ever see more than five doors or less than five to three doors? Two doors?
I think, as we get into the future where,
will the whole lid just pop up and we'll step into it like some of those futuristic cars, the whole body flips up and you sit down in it, or?
I would direct people to look at the history of horse and buggy and imagine the horseless carriage still being a horseless carriage, but now that the horse will become the artificial intelligence.
Right.
So these kind of upright proportions of the carriages, if you think of like the Wells Fargo stagecoach thing, there's some hints about the future in those. Big wheels, something you can stand in, something you can walk right in.
Something you can stand in. I never thought of it. So this isn't transportation doesn't have to be on your butt. You might lay in it. You might stand in it. You might do other things than just sit in it.
I think people in the future will look, when they get into vehicles that have this sort of carriage seating and tall space, if they got into a modern day, say, like S-Class Mercedes and had to crane their neck the way you do to get in that back seat, they will say, like, why were people accepting this odd contortionist position you have to get into to get into a car? And it's because we normalize what we feel comfortable with, what becomes fashionable.
Yeah.
But we do normalize something. Even I have an 85 Celica GTS convertible, and when I get in that car, I have to sit down. And it feels so strange to me because no car you sit down, even my little Fiat, my modern one, you slide right in the H point, which is your H point, slides right into the seat. Whereas that Celica, it's like, oh, wow, I can't believe everybody used to just fall into their car. It's hard to get out of.
Yeah.
Also, it could be that I'm, 45 now. So
And they had kind of a bucket. I'm old enough to remember the step-down designs of Packards and those things where you step down. You step over a thing and then down into it. It had a felt like a bucket, right? It felt like a well. All right, so we've talked about that a little bit. Now here's the one that and this is going to lead us into the next discussion. So we'll end this first half with I cried about the passenger vehicle,
don't
but you cheered me up. Exactly, and we talked about how we're just left with trucks and SUVs or whatever they're called now. The question I have is colors and shapes. Why have we gotten so unimaginative in colors and shapes? My wife and I were laughing about this the other day. You got me thinking about this stuff now. We're driving down the road, and it seems like all the cars are white, black, or some kind of gray, silver, whatever.
We like to call it gray.
Grayish, with a handful of red just to stand out. No pinks, no purples, no greens anymore, blues hardly any. All of that stuff's gone. Brown,
Well, we need Brenda Parkin back, our guest that we had earlier, the Nissan color material designer for Nissan for all those years, who did Xterra yellow and really pushed things like shock blue on Xterra, which people don't remember shock blue, but they remember yellow Xterra. Shock blue was like a Smurf blue, but it was a secondary color for Xterra. She really pushed hard for colors. I think two answers to that. Why do we go to grayish? Grayish is basically some nebulous place between tan and gray, right? With metallic thrown in to make it fancy.
Right.
But why are we there? And there's a lot of different answers to that question, but the biggest one, I think, is the one that's about to change, which is people lease vehicles or they buy them for a shorter amount of time than they used to, and they're thinking so much more about resale value. Mm. How can I move this car once I get out of this lease? How can I sell this car once this person gets out of the lease? So they'll order cars that are more like that. People who are buying cars will buy them for a lesser amount of time, and so they'll want to be able to get rid of it, right? So they're not thinking about their personal preference. They're thinking about sort of a market blandness that doesn't offend anybody.
But that's the opposite of what's happened in our culture. We've gone from 3 channels to 3 million cable channels to 3 zillion YouTube channels. You know, we've gone from radio, which had top 20, top 40, right, to Pandora with endless, or Spotify, endless choices. Endless choices is the modern mantra, and yet in cars we've gone back to you can have any color you want as long as it's black. Henry Ford's day.
Yeah. Well, and you know, in some ways the car industry leads, and in some ways you can, it takes its cues from other industries a few years behind. But what I would say is that you hit it right on the head. Endless choice is definitely something I see coming back into this industry. And when I say, and more than choice, you know, whereas choice is, let's say, customization. I mean, you can customize your news feed,
right.
But a real endless choice is personalization. Personalization is different than customization. Customization is selecting from a menu. Personalization is you're the only one that has it.
I like that.
And I think with all of these manufacturing techniques that are coming into the norm, everything from 3D printing to, you know, major sophisticated, you know, I won't go into it because it's like a downfall of like processes, but like every manufacturing technique that is going to make it possible for low run small numbers production to be profitable is going to mean that people will be able to imagine and personalize their own vehicle or their own ride experience, if you can imagine that. So go beyond color, go into smart skins or smart glass, where the color or the content on the car changes itself. So you could see, you can imagine a car driving down the road with graphics changing all the time.
Sort of like those tintable glasses you go out in the sun and they tint for you or something, and then they go back to...
Yeah, but imagine with actual live graphics in them, like your computer monitor.
You're blowing my mind here.
Yeah, like, you know, think very Minority Report. That stuff is becoming, you know, very, very near future. I think the biggest in this idea of commitment, which is what causes people to make conservative choices, that sort of disappears when you can change the vehicle like a chameleon for the ride you're about to get in.
Yeah.
You know, so let's say that you're
just
not,
that ride today. I want to be purple and pink and wild, and I want to flames on the side here. Yeah.
Yeah, or and you may not even make this choice consciously.
It may be a reaction to your mood, like a mood, those old mood rings of the 70s or 80s or something here.
Yeah, you know, anticipatory vehicles. And if you think about, like, vehicles...
Anticipatory vehicle. How would you like to feel today, Brian?
Yeah, but less creepy. More like... like, in the way that when you do put on a shirt in the morning, you sort of... It's something that you feel. The car that sort of creates an ambient temperature and an experience for you that you can correct. I think that the vision of the future where the car is doing a lot of talking and like harping at you, like in the sort of 80s version of the future where the coolest thing was like a Datsun Maxima that said like left door is open.
Yeah,
it's less that and it's more about creating you know, the right temperature, the right fragrance, the right color light that you like.
Wow.
But very naturally. Yeah, less of the sort of mechanical, like that creeps me out. You know, there's a thing they call the uncanny valley, which we could spend a whole show on. Uncanny valley is that space.
We should do that, yeah.
Yeah, it's that space, real quick. It's that space between a real live object and a computer. And at some point, the computer gets a little closer to becoming alive and human, to the point where we anthropomorphize it, like a car that we give a name to or any sort of like pet object that we love and we name, we imbue it with a
like Knight Rider and Kit. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and Kit really approached Uncanny Valley. So Uncanny Valley is that moment of creepiness when it goes too far from us adding our own anthropomorphic values to it coming at us with something that definitely does not feel a lot. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel human. It feels creepy. That's the, if you put it on a belt, like on a curve, that's the valley.
For me, it started when it would beep if I didn't connect my seatbelt here. You know, it would endlessly ding and like, enough. And I'm arguing, stop it already. All right, I'll put my seatbelt on. Yeah.
Or, you know, like maybe some of the early Avatar movies. Avatar was amazing, right? But there are some of those moments, like when the graphics weren't right and you're like, wait a minute, this doesn't feel... That's the uncanny valley. When you look at it and you don't believe it, but if there's something triggers your mind to make you feel off versus something that just feels naturally alive. You sort of welcome it and you accept it versus reject it. And that's the trick for a designer, to sort of find their way in and out of that valley without creeping people out.
Well, my way is to find a way out of this conversation without pissing people off here, because you're into something really cool. Let's stick around, folks, because we're going to do part two and we're going to get into this futuristic stuff of the we're going to enter that creepy valley here and walk into the future and see if we can creep you out even more here.
Get out of it. Okay. All right.
You've been listening to a quick look back this year as we finish the first season of Driven by Design right here on Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.